Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM and streaming at kboo.fm. This is Lori Mercier, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the collective of agitator moles provide interviews, reviews, and views from an anti-colonial, anti-racist, socialist, feminist perspective. I'm recording the show from home, as are all the KBOO volunteers these days who, like me, may not have the best equipment, but we're making do and continuing to put important programming on the air. Thanks to Old Mole Patricia Colbert for producing today's show, and a special shout out to Jenna, Celeste, Tammy, Arthur, Jenka, and all the KBOO staff for all their hard work in these challenging times to keep the station operating 24/7. And listeners, KBOO needs your financial and volunteer support if you can offer it. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. The Mole goes where corporate media fear to tread, supporting grassroots challenges to top-down authority and giving voice to movements that shake the foundations of an unjust society. Today, we're focusing on how to understand and survive the pandemic and how to challenge the corrupt capitalist structures that continue to siphon resources upwards to the 1%. As Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said in opposition to the Republican Senate bill just passed, it provides trillions of dollars in corporate bailout money with no strings attached, while providing little more than crumbs for millions of unemployed workers. Yet despite the dismal prospects of American politics, we find hope in the crisis with growing momentum in support of universal health care, housing for all, and workers at Amazon and elsewhere demanding fairer treatment and safer working conditions. People want radical change, and we can seize this moment to push for it. First on today's show, Bill Resnick continues the second of a two-part interview with Dr. Michael Friedman, a microbiologist who studies the relationship between environmental degradation and the emergence of human pathogens like COVID-19. In last week's interview, Dr. Friedman discussed how capitalist expansionism set the stage for the transfer of the virus from animal to human through deforestation and declining biodiversity. In today's interview, Friedman discusses short-term solutions when a new virus surfaces and the necessary long-term solutions that include an alternative economic system that respects the natural ecosystems upon which health and life depend. Then I talk with Old Mole Joe Clement about the Multnomah County Library expansion bond, which will appear on the November ballot. Joe holds a light up to the neoliberal concepts and practices sneaking in to our most socialist of institutions. Libraries are among our most treasured community resources that we need to protect from this neoliberal agenda. Finally, in honor of National Poetry Month, Patricia Kohlberg discusses the 1968 poem, They Feed, They Lion, by former U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, and what the poem might mean for us today as we grapple with the devastation of climate change and pandemic disease. Now, here is Bill Resnick with Michael Friedman.
Hi, Michael Friedman. Welcome to KABU for part two of our interview on COVID-19.
Thanks, Bill. I'm glad to be here with you again.
Mike Friedman is an evolutionary biologist studying microbes, teaching and writing in the biology department at the University of Antigua and Barbuda in the Caribbean. For the last several years, he's been studying and writing on the development of dangerous viruses around the planet, including COVID-19. That respiratory disease has now been detected in over 360,000 people in this country, which is more than double any other country, including populous China. And it's now killed over 10,000 at this date, which is an undercount because many people who died were never tested. This interview was recorded last week, Monday. Today, when you're hearing it, the figures will be much worse, maybe with 20,000 deaths and many more to come. In the first part of the interview, Mike discussed the origins of the virus and the conditions of its transfer to humans. He discussed how our current economic system, its relentless expansionism going to the ends of the earth and the depths of the ocean, making a lot of money, but devastating ecological systems and putting animals into closer contact with humans. He also discussed the virus's ease of transmission, also that it can be spread by people who show no symptoms, and also that it very quickly spreads in populations with no prior immunity, leading to a very large number of cases and thus mass death. The second part will build on all that to discuss first short-term solutions when a new virus surfaces, solutions that were done in China, Korea, and Germany to a good effect, to say the least, and not done in this country, though epidemiologists issued from early on progressively more desperate warnings. And we'll be discussing long-term solutions, how humanity can act so that fewer of the viruses are created and passed to humans. A hint, it would require a very different economic system than we have now. So some things can be done today that would reduce virus attack frequency and prepare for that alternative system. So, Mike, what did China, Korea, and Germany do, apparently stopping the virus?
Well, for one thing, except for China, they started early. Germany and South Korea had preparations in place as soon as the epidemic began spreading in China. The second thing they did was implement massive testing. So South Korea, for example, was doing 20,000 tests a day. I believe that was the figure. While the U.S., from what, January or December to February, had only done about 1,000 or 2,000 tests throughout the country. So testing is critical. When the testing began revealing the points of contact, they were able to implement contact tracing and then various mechanisms of containment, social isolation. So they would trace contacts, and then they would isolate people who tested positive or came in with symptoms. All of this was done very expeditiously, and that allowed South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, now Germany is considered to be a good example, to deal with the pandemic and to actually hold the numbers down. Whether it continues to hold the numbers down is something that needs to be monitored.
Yeah, often the economic geniuses of those countries decide we have to open the country and regain our consumption and profits, and they do it very soon, and still the virus is still there, and most of the population has not gotten it, right? The immune system wasn't challenged, and therefore you get up and bump a second great outbreak of cases. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know very much about the development of immunity to this disease. So that still is an open question. What percentage of the population will develop immunity? How they'll develop immunity and for how long the immunity will last? there have been some indications of reinfection in some places. Whether that's because of faulty testing or because of actual reinfection, we aren't sure. So these are open questions.
If it follows, though, the pattern of the common flu, the immunity lasts for a year or two or three, something like that. Is that what the scientists have found?
Yeah, the virus mutates, and you have to develop a new vaccine every year. But in the case of coronavirus, there's another problem, which is there's some discussion over whether the way the immune system responds to the virus will actually produce the degree of immunity that we need. So there's some discussion over that. Yeah, we will see some immunity, but no one really knows how much.
Mike, what happened in the U.S.? Tell us why the United States is so late and is going to have so many deaths.
Well, as most of your listeners probably already know, the biggest shortcoming is structural. I mean, we've had four decades of neoliberal austerity, which have reduced the healthcare system, have reduced the stocks of supplies and protective equipment, beds, hospital beds. So I think this is a basic difference, in fact, between the U.S. in a way, in the U.S. and Germany. Germany has also experienced austerity, but some of the original social democratic programs that were in place following World War II are still in place in Germany. So in the U.S., what happened was, on top of these structural failures, you had a problem, well, you had more specific issues related to this, like the CDC failing to produce a viable test kit, and then failing to take this seriously enough to get it out, and imposing criteria for testing that were very, very strict. So that was one side. Then they also limited the ability of the states and of private companies to produce their own test kits. They put a lot of red tape in the way of doing this. And they also refused to use the German kit, which had been around since February, I believe. So Germans produced the test kit, which they were using, and which the WHO adopted. Then you have other issues, like, for example, the private drug companies. This is not related to the onset of the disease, but they showed their colors when they, at least a couple of them, refused to say whether they would make any antivirals or vaccines available to the public cheaply and easily. Then there was an outcry, and I believe one of the companies backed down and said, yes, what they were working on would be made available. So those are a few of the ways that we were off to a slow start. So the U.S. started very slow, and it started very slow from the top down because Donald Trump was a little bit more concerned about reassuring Wall Street than about actually sending a clear message about how to deal with the virus and taking steps to do so.
Yeah, the Army, apparently, the military had established in the National Security Council, that's their peak association advising the president, to set up a pandemic task force because the Army, as terrible their uses are around the world, they have some smart people on top who actually have done risk assessment, and they have found that pandemics are an enormous risk, along with climate change, actually. What they would do about it is another matter. And then they set up this group in the National Security Council to plan and advise the president and blah, blah. Anyway, he shut it down, didn't he, early in his term. It was sort of incomprehensible that they would do that. But
yeah, he eliminated that office. In line with his other anti-science and anti-working class measures, I mean, he took public health officials off of his, once he set up his panel under Kushner, the COVID-19 panel or group that he had assigned the task of coming up with policy, he took public health officials off of that, off of his COVID-19 panel. And, you know, he placed the panel under Vice President Pence, who has no expertise in public health. Then he also classified the information coming out of that panel so providers don't have access to the data they need.
Yeah, and then finally he decided that Pence wasn't doing what he wanted, so he put Jared Kushner as head of it. This is Bill Resnick here from Little Mole, interviewing Mike Friedman, microbiologist, observes and studies viruses like COVID-19. Last week, we discussed the origins of the virus transferred to humans, concluding that the recent very frequent appearance of new novel viruses has to be attributed to the relentless penetration and consequent devastation of jungles, forests, other lands, like companies and governments going after the oil or hardwoods or minerals or cow pastures to make money. We just, in the second part of the interview, discussed what must be done after a virus is discovered to stop the potential pandemic and give time for science to develop vaccines. Next, we'll talk about what can be done long-term to reduce the novel virus origination, to stop pandemics, and to greatly reduce death. Mike, last week you discussed Wuhan province in China, where COVID-19 had its first reported outbreak and deaths. Although you also pointed out that the great increase in novel viruses being passed to humans is a global phenomenon, and at least in one developed country, this one. Tell us about that, the viruses that have developed in this country and why, like Lyme and Hanta and maybe more.
Very briefly, there's been a big upsurge in the past 40 years, which is why I said that these emerging diseases and outbreaks are a true product of the Anthropocene. The upsurge in the U.S. has been accompanied by increasing agribusiness, increasing suburban development, increasing extractive industry development, and so on. These are all associated with deforestation, with bringing populations of people into closer proximity with vectors and primary hosts, and allowing these hosts to proliferate. So hantavirus, for example, is a rodent-borne virus in the southwestern United States, and it began proliferating when the suburbs began spreading, or really intensified their spreading, like in Arizona, New Mexico, and so on. And this is associated with increased agribusiness and irrigation and so on in the Southwest, and also with suburbanization and urbanization. So we have these industries to thank, along with the real estate industry and financial industries. And so it's all market driven. If people want a good take on how this is occurring, they can look for some of the work of Rob Wallace, a biologist who wrote a recent article in Monthly Review. He talks about this.
Yeah. What about Lyme disease?
Lyme disease is also associated with land development and deforestation in the northeastern U.S. So the real estate industry began, you know, after World War II, began promoting the sprawl of suburbs. And these suburbs are very favorable habitats for the deer mites, which spread Lyme disease. And then on top of that, you also have the effects of climate change, because with climate change, the vectors and hosts of the Lyme disease bacteria are spreading out across northern U.S. And they're finding cases of Lyme disease that have moved like into Michigan and further west.
Yeah. Mike, I know that the publications that you publish in cover the devastation of nature by our current economic relationships, it's called capitalism. And those publications also talk about alternatives to capitalism, and point out we have to end capitalism, its relentless growth that ignores the fact that you can't have infinite or exponential growth on a finite planet. Say a few words on that, the way you understand it. I think we have to talk about what can be done in the struggle with capitalism and with this relentless growth. There are things that can be done that will, in fact, reduce novel virus origination, as well as the transfer to humans and all of the deaths. But first, tell us, you know, give us your statement on the problem of exponential growth.
Okay, well, I mean, I think not the biological route of pandemics, because those have always been with us, and there's always a chance that some disease is going to emerge and spread out. But kind of the roots of our current situation, in which you're having widespread outbreaks of very virulent diseases at an increasing pace, is kind of due to the intrinsic dynamic of a market economy, which is based on, incessant growth, capital accumulation, destruction of the environment, which is considered an externality, as well as the health of working people. And in the process, you set up the dynamic that I mentioned before, where you are fostering contact between humans, especially vulnerable humans, and these diseases. You're reducing biodiversity, which favors these diseases. So, I mean, the solution, the bottom line kind of, for assuring that we have some control over these emerging diseases is to eliminate the market economy.
Yeah, that'll take a while, though. I think it's truly eliminating itself, actually. It's creating the conditions for its replacement. That may be too Marxian for some, but it seems that they're not going to be able to get out of this one. They're not going to be able to jumpstart growth to get out of a crisis, which they've always done before. They have to stop growing in the way they are, and they're unable to even imagine doing that. They will make conditions that will destroy them. In the meantime, though, and it will take a while because they have such political hegemony, indeed domination, there are things that we can do now, it seems to me, that would both prepare for that day of replacing capitalism, that we can prepare for that as well as reduce the amount of misery and death from these novel viruses.
Okay. I mean, the way I kind of envision it is that we need sort of an expanded Green New Deal. We need a program that's going to address these environmental issues while providing jobs and economic security, food security, housing security, you know, basic needs for people. And at the same time, we need a Medicare for all. So we need to amplify the Green New Deal to incorporate Medicare for all, universal health care, I would say, because both of these are necessary in the short and in the long run to prevent and stop these pandemics from taking the toll they do.
In Germany, in fact, it does still have a medical system set up by social democrats, although practicing austerity in many other ways. In Germany, the health system was fully prepared, and they have, in fact, had very few, at least the reports, and German reports are usually accurate nowadays. U.S. reports and others are very questionable, but at least their reports show very few deaths per case discovered, although, of course, they also tested so many people that they have very many cases. But they also have very good, they have a medical system that gets to people who are having the early signs of the disease and treats them. And it seems to me that early treatment can be greatly reduce deaths.
Yeah. So, I mean, what you're talking about is a much more robust healthcare system and also public health system. And Germany certainly has great advantages in those over the United States. The other side of it, though, is the need to reduce the causes of these outbreaks, which does imply an entire environmental component. We need to begin looking at how to protect ecosystems and prevent biodiversity decline. And that involves things like agroecological production. It involves things like setting aside areas which maintain, you know, original ecosystems.
It also involves restoring some of the damaged ecosystems.
Exactly. But it also involves assuring that people have enough food to eat and aren't constantly being forced off the land to move further into forests to find food or to cultivate, bringing them into contact with reduced and immunocompromised animals that are being affected by this biodiversity decline. I remember when I lived in Nicaragua, a big problem was that the landowners would push the poor campesinos, the poor farmers, off their land, and then they would migrate further into the forest and slash and burn the forest, And what we know now is that these type of activities expose people to the risk of contracting various pathogens from organisms that are being pushed into smaller and smaller spaces and with reduced diversity.
Yeah, and also, of course, aggravating climate change, producing more greenhouse gas emissions. Mike, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Bill. It was really nice joining you today. We'll talk to you later.
Right.
Pandemic is spreading, the health system's collapsing. You can watch it all unfolding on the screen. If you're afraid to go outside, enough groceries to hide, it may have been weeks since you have seen someone you can touch, and you miss it so much as you wonder what might happen next. Like when your savings run out and the choice is all about what kind of help you might be able to expect. Perhaps when COVID arrived, while some struggled to survive, you were what they call essential. It didn't take long to see you got that wrong. The word they really meant was expendable. It didn't take long to see there was no emergency. Plans in place for something which all the scientists knew was just a matter of when there'd be a pandemic again. And the kleptocrats in power didn't have a clue. Otherwise, why did Jason Hargrove die?
We just heard a piece from David Rovick's new song, Essentially Expendable, The Death of Jason Hargrove. Hargrove is the Detroit bus driver who needlessly passed away from his exposure to COVID-19, representing one of many thousands of blue-collar workers who have been on the front lines of this pandemic but lack the support of employers in providing adequate protection. Before the music, we heard from the Old Moles, Bill Resnick, and microbiologist Dr. Michael Friedman. Now, Joe Clement is with me on the phone. Joe is one of our standard Old Mole contributors. They are a steward of the Ask Me Local 88 and an employee of Multnomah County Library. Today, we're talking about the Multnomah County Library District Board's bond measure that will be on the November 2020 ballot to increase the East County Library's total square footage by nearly 50%. This intends to address that about 40% of Multnomah County's population is east of Interstate 205, but only 20% of library space is in that region. So if approved, the measure would build, rebuild, or renovate 7 library spaces, add modern technology, infrastructure, including gigabyte speed internet, and update library facilities and materials handling. The measure would create a community-based oversight and reporting body. And there has been much enthusiasm for this bond. Who can oppose expansion of a library given its critical importance to our communities? But we want to talk about some of the disturbing trends in not only this bond measure, but in libraries more broadly, and what modernization might mean. So, Joe, from your perspective, how will modernization occur, and what does this mean for workers in the Multnomah County library system?
Well, libraries across the country and the world have used automated processes and machines for decades now.
Processes for handling their materials when they're checked in or going to different branches. And the Multnomah County Library in the bond that it is proposing is aiming to introduce more of this kind of technology into the branches. It already has put a pilot of some automated materials check-in and sorting machines at the Midland Library that came online just about when everything shut down. And so we don't know what that's going to be like as an impact on our actual community. But the expectation is that this pilot would prove successful and that they would introduce it into other library branches, which would allow them to budget fewer workers whose labor the machines are, in theory, conserving and front-loading and making more efficient, to be repurposed for other things, whether other kinds of library worker jobs or even security. But in the case of the bond and its aspiration of a much needed East County flagship building, the automation is a way of making it possible to fund the staffing of that library while only adding 10 to 20 jobs to the actual library system.
And that's a pretty tiny percentage of new workers given the demands that such a large library, similar to the main central library in downtown Portland, would need, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's important to note that being in East County means that this library would be an addition to that community in terms of jobs and hires. There would be external and internal hires, but the system as a whole would be funding that by creating working conditions that the workers are not looking forward to in other parts of the library system. And this has been the library's main frame for the importance of this, is that it is an equity issue, and that is something that no one can disagree with. But we have to kind of be asking ourselves, what is the engine of transformation here? And it's following a way of thinking about organizations in public service that is called neoliberalism. It's called capitalist realism. It's this view toward making the human element of our institutions as minimal as possible because they cost so much. And that's one of the hidden issues of the automation, is that on the front side, the public facing side, the message is we want to deliver materials to you faster and more efficiently, which is true, and we could expect to see some improvement on that. But the underside of that, which is what we hear in the library, is that labor costs are going up, and a large contributor of that, a disproportionate contributor of that, is the private health insurance that our employer-based health insurance forces the county libraries to fund. And there's a disconnect between the real drivers of the squeeze on libraries.
And that kind of squeeze we see, well, we just saw last year with the cuts in the parks budget cuts, which laid off many workers. And of course, these were middle class jobs that the city was losing in part to cover these costs, not only of the private healthcare system, but also in redirecting limited funds into areas that were not actually employing the workers who were providing those needed services to communities across the city. And so, you know, this kind of neoliberal model that has invaded the public sphere as well as the private is as much at work here as the Pentagon in terms of how corporate vendors and investors are influencing library services. And do you want to say something about that angle of this push for automating and investing in new technology? You know, what might appear to our listeners and users of libraries as important, access to ebooks and so on, without fully recognizing what more and more investment in that technological delivery means in terms of relationships with corporate providers?
Yeah, libraries have been paying outside organizations, often organizations that are incorporated, and so they are corporations, to provide ebooks and other digital content, but also machines that we use. Automated sorters and check-in machines would be ours, but the deep service of them would be something that is outsourced. The same thing goes for our space saver shelving that allows us to store things extra tight in our off public areas. But then ebooks themselves are less like public property that the library owns and more like rental property that the the license to has to be renewed after so many uses or a period of time. And, you know, this is a devil's bargain, is I think the real takeaway. It's not that there's anything nefarious going on right now, but that it is part and parcel of a kind of auctioning and partitioning off of the commons, that when it is owned directly by the public, you know, we actually kind of have security in that. And as things are farmed out to private corporations, whether they're doing the right thing or not now, it means that the money that taxpayers pay for these public goods is going out into the broader economy, rather than staying with the actual community where the goods are supposed to serve.
So it's not the technology per se that's the problem. It's the way in which technology, or these technological ebooks and other prize introductions into places or spaces like libraries, are privately owned. And so instead of investing in a book that might remain on the shelf for decades, there's this repeated requirement to continue using public resources to pay off these corporate providers.
Yeah, and the idea of use, while important, is also in some quarters kind of fetishized, where if things don't get used, they don't have value. And this is kind of a perennial debate within libraries, because weeding is a kind of practical necessity. When you're adding to collections, you run out of room unless you make room. And how do you make room? But it runs obviously into intellectual freedom and censorship questions when books are not replaced and no one's asking why not, if there is actually maybe some merit. And I think it goes to librarians who make those decisions to have an ethics. But when we're talking about public goods and kind of accountability structures, it's not like there's an oversight committee to make sure that books get replaced. And by transferring the actual holding from a physical book to a digital one, which a number of friends I have complained about, they can't find a book except in ebook form, this makes that power play all the more easy to execute.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7. This is Lori Mercier speaking with Joe Clement about the upcoming Multnomah County Library District Board bond measure and libraries in general and their place in the general privatization of public services. So, Joe, we were earlier talking about an article by Ben Webster, which we can post on the Old Mole's website, his article about how library workers themselves have become part of this mentality of reducing the skills, you know, the general process of skill destruction that takes place in any workplace, and about how so much library work is becoming minding of the machine. So do you want to say anything about just the nature of work in libraries and how this automation and new emphasis on technology is changing that work?
Well, libraries have, you know, undergone a transformation over decades and centuries, and the growth of large library systems in stable states over the last couple hundred years has led to divisions of labor. So you don't just have librarians like you did 100 years ago who did virtually all of the work that makes the library. You have access services, which is what we call the people in our library system who shelve the books, but who also check them out to you when you want to take one away. And then the librarians and their assistants who provide information services, answering not just kind of where do I find this, but helping you actually decide what it is you really need to be looking for to find what you're looking for. So in our library, we have this division between the access services and the information services. And over time, there's been an offloading of job duties. Workers with higher pay rates lose duties to lower paid workers who are, they're giving them, you are now going to do this. You're now going to process holds, check them out and put them on the hold shelf, where before that was only the purview of these higher paid workers. Most dramatically, we saw that a few years ago when they decided to change the job classification of library workers who were called pages, who just did materials handling, to this hybrid of the page and the clerk classification. And so we've seen what we do in the library change a lot. And I know it's not unique to Multnomah County Library or even really to libraries. It's a kind of process of making workers more flexible and more interchangeable so that there's less barriers to making sure that the work gets done. But in the library, you know, you could be doing some of these discrete tasks, like you shelf books, or you check books out, but, you know, you're basically on hand for any kind of question people have. And that has, over the recent years, blown up into a full-on need for social workers, because we have a disproportionate amount of people who have nowhere else to go who come to the libraries. The libraries are basically day shelters in places that don't have day shelters, or that they have shelters but people have to leave in the morning and can't come back till night. Emilio Estevez made a movie. I'm going to say it's a so-so movie, but it's worth watching because you've never seen a movie like it, called The Public, which is about this issue of what happens when people who have nowhere else to go, you know, turn to the library and say, don't kick us out. So we're juggling a lot of technical skills, but then emotional and social skills that I think a lot of workers in service industries are expected to do in some manner. But in the library's case, it, you know, it's really a matter of our ideals of what the library is even about. It's a place where we are affirming and supporting the community. And so people come in with all kinds of needs that are changing what people think libraries are about.
And yet those service workers who are so critical and who are facing the community, really on the front lines of serving so many different needs in the community, are not paid for the work that they do or for the value of the labor that they provide. Joe Clement, just in the remaining minute or so that we have, since this is a time when that critical space, the library space, is closed due to the pandemic, do you want to remind listeners about some of the services that they can still access at this moment?
Yeah, the library still has all kinds of these electronic and digital materials, so to speak, for checkout or streaming use. If you can access the library's website, multcolib.org, you go to the main page and there's a tab right there in front of you that says ebooks and more. That, you know, takes you to all of those collections. But then you can also still email the library with questions of all the sorts that we ever took before, whether it's research, whether it's information about COVID-19, information about pandemics and history. You can still ask questions of that by going to the Contact Us section of that website. Unfortunately, we don't have phone-based services. They have not figured out a way to make that work, but you can call somebody you do know who can access the internet, and they can forward your question the way I just described.
Okay, Joe Clement, thanks so much for talking with us today about, well, really these illuminating insights about the challenges facing libraries, the changes that have been happening, and the ways we might want to think about this upcoming Multnomah County Library bond measure and how those resources that are sorely needed might be allocated differently to address not only the community's concerns, but also the need for good library workers to help provide our community's important services and access. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land.
the Lord Moses said, let my people go. If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead. Let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell all Pharaoh to let my people go.
Thank you, Joe, for those reflections appropriate for National Library Workers Day. Today is also Passover, and we thought it fitting to play Paul Robeson's rendition of Go Down Moses, a song that represented liberation of the ancient Jewish people from Egyptian slavery and was also interpreted by African Americans as their own escape of American slavery. Now here is Patricia Kohlberg reflecting on Philip Levine's poem, They Feed, They Lion. In this most famous of his working-class poems, Levine exposes the origins of Black rage and resistance in the industrial world of Detroit, deploying his signature stark and uncompromising language.
Out of burlap sacks, out of bearing butter, out of black bean and wet slate bread, out of the acids of rage, the candor of tar, out of creosote, gasoline, drive shafts, wooden dollies, they lion grow. These are the opening lines of Philip Levine's famed working-class poem entitled They Feed, They Lion. Words incantatory and propulsive, gritty and fierce. Levine wrote the poem in 1968, 1 year after the Great Rebellion in Detroit, usually referred to by the white racist press as the Detroit Race Riots. The Great Rebellion, in fact, involved white as well as black communities rising up against a common oppressor. Levine's poem evokes the provenance of explosive black rage in the industrial squalor of Detroit, and at the end, the author's anguished realization that, in Levine's own words, quote, I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. I was now middle-aged, I was middle class, and I was white. Here is a young Philip Levine reading, They Feed, They Lion.
Out of burlap sacks, out of bearing butter, out of black bean and wet slate bread, out of the acids of rage, the candor of tar, out of creosote, gasoline, drive shafts, wooden dollies, they lie and grow. Out of the gray hills of industrial barns, out of rain, out of bus ride West Virginia to kiss my ass, out of buried aunties, mothers hardening like pounded stumps, out of stumps, out of the bones need to sharpen and the muscles to stretch, they lie and grow. Earth is eating trees, fence posts, gutted cars. Earth is calling in her little ones, come home, come home. From pig balls, from the ferocity of pig driven to holiness, from the furred ear and the full jowl come the repose of the hung belly, from the purpose they lie and grow. From the sweet glues of the trotters come the sweet kinks of the fist. From the full flower of the hams, the thorax of caves, from bow down come rise up, come they lion from the reeds of shovels, the grained arm that pulls the hands, they lion grow. From my five arms and all my hands, from all my white sins forgiven they feed, from my car passing under the stars they lion, from my children inherit, from the oak turned to a wall they lion, from they sack and they belly opened and all that was hidden burning on the oil-stained earth. They feed they lion, and he comes.
Philip Levine was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants who grew up in Detroit during the Great Depression, during a time as well of growing alliance between the working class communities of Jews and Blacks. In the 1950s, Levine worked in the auto factories of Chevrolet and Cadillac. Levine said of that time, "I saw that the people that I was working with were voiceless in a way. In terms of the literature of the United States, they weren't being heard. Nobody was speaking for them. And as young people will, you know, I took this foolish vow that I would speak for them, and that's what my life would be." Levine went on to pen hundreds of poems that celebrated working class life and resistance, poems which, according to his friend and fellow poet Christopher Buckley, consistently rescue our dignity and humanity and sustain hope in some moral sense of the world. His poems rescue the lives of the workers who built this country, the lives of the historically dispossessed, the lives of those who in the Spanish Civil War fought for the right to live freely, who shook their bloody fists in the face of fascism. Levine, who served as the 2011-2012 U.S. Poet Laureate, was the recipient of multiple prizes for his poetry, including a National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. One day back in the 1950s, Levine and a Black co-worker by the name of Eugene were loading parts into burlap bags. The Black man held up a bag to show Levine. It was from the Detroit Municipal Zoo. Eugene laughed and said, "They feed, they lion, they meal in they sacks," slipping into a Black vernacular, as Levine remembers it, to invoke the world of Black folks, and a world, as they both understood, was off limits to Levine. The image and the rhythm and the insistent use of they in his friend's utterance haunted Levine for years, until he returned to Detroit in 1968 to the devastated neighborhood of his youth and was inspired to write They Feed, They Lion. The poem lays out a series of disturbing images of industrial exploitation, immiseration, and greed, the buried aunties and mothers hardening like pounded stumps, earth-eating trees and gutted cars. But the lion also grows out of the imperative to live, the bones need to sharpen and the muscles to stretch. These images lead the reader to the furred ear, the full jowl, and the repose of the hung belly of the pig, the exploiting class that feeds the lion of Black rage and resistance. From the pig comes the sweet kinks of the fist of Black agency, and it is the lion that moves them from bow down to rise up. The final stanza lays bare the poet's sense of his own complicity in the suffering of Black people, followed by a final wrenching and violent image. Reading again from the poem, "From my five arms and all my hands, from all my white sins forgiven, they feed. From my car passing under the stars, they lion from my children inherit. From the oak turned to a wall, they lion, from they sack and they belly opened, and all that was hidden burning on the oil-stained earth, they feed, they lion, and he comes." As we struggle against the twin existential crises of the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change, Levine's poem speaks to the third crisis of our time, a vast and growing inequality of wealth. All three crises are the products of an age-old class oppression due to a system which seeks to dominate not only the whole of mankind, but the natural world as well, in order to benefit a tiny but immensely powerful international class of elites. As Levine's poem should remind us, it is a heavily racialized working-class exploitation that underpins the power of capital. In closing, I turn again to Levine's own words from the 1983 documentary entitled Anarchism in America. I know that the government in Washington is full of terrible people with terrible plans. They will murder people here and abroad to gain more power. Those who have dominated our country most of my adult life are interested in maintaining an empire, subjugating other people, enslaving them if need be, and finally killing those who protest so that wealthy and powerful Americans can go on enjoying their advantages over others. Levine then asks, what can we do? And his answer is still relevant today. We can hang on and encourage each other, dig in, protest in every peaceful way possible, and hope that people are better than they seem. We can describe ourselves as horribly racist people, which we are, as imperialists, which we have been and are, but we can also see ourselves as bountiful, gracious, full of wit, courage, resourcefulness. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been discussing Philip Levine's 1968 poem, They Feed, They Lion.
Thank you, Patricia, for that beautiful and powerful analysis of Philip Levine's poem. Thanks, too, for producing the show. We appreciate it so much. And we also want to thank Bill Resnick, Michael Friedman, and Joe Clement for their contributions today. You can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website, and you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. If you have any suggestions for future content for the Old Mole Variety Hour, or leads on potential guests, or writing you'd like to hear read on the air, or if you'd like to learn how to produce radio with us and share your skills, please send us an email. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m. These are challenging times for everyone, and your favorite radio station, KBOO, is also facing challenges. If you can share a little love, please go to kboo.fm and click on the red donate button to help support essential, non-commercial community radio.